afternoon, everyone. From Washington, D.C., we bring you a broadcast of the luncheon session of the People's Lobby. Today's guest speakers will be introduced by Mr. Benjamin C. Marsh, the Executive Secretary of the People's Lobby. Mr. Marsh.
Before I introduce either of the speakers for this afternoon, I want to request that you take a minute and invite your neighbors over the telephone to listen in to Congressman Ernest Lundeen and Mr. Gardner Jackson, who will tell you facts about the conditions here in Washington, which you should all know. Congressman Lundeen, many of you will recall, was defeated for re-election to Congress because he voted against America's getting into the World War. Morgan was in favor of it. I'm very glad to introduce Congressman Ernest Lundeen, author with Senator Frazier of a real security bill, who will speak to you on Social Security.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Mr. Chairman, fellow citizens, 8 months ago, I spoke to you in this same room at a noon meeting sponsored by the People's Lobby. I said to you at that time that the American people expect adequate, genuine social security, including unemployment, accident, maternity, and health insurance and old age pension. I said to you 8 months ago, in the near future, the American people will learn that under the administration Social Security bill, 15 million now unemployed will receive nothing. And those who are now employed must wait for years before they are eligible to pitiably and utterly inadequate sums for unemployment insurance in the future. And I said, when the American people analyze the provisions of the administration measure, they will demand a new or revised social insurance bill. William Green, president of the American Federation of Labor, knew what he was talking about when he said last year that the administration's Social Security Act would be, quote, pitiably and utterly inadequate, end quote. So far, the press reports only 9 states and the District of Columbia have passed unemployment insurance laws, and only 18 states have old age pension laws that meet the federal requirements. No wonder Abraham Epstein, Executive Secretary of the American Association for Social Security, calls the administration bill the Social Insecurity Act. We do have a real Social Security legislation before Congress, the Frazier-Lundeen Social Security Bill, introduced on Monday, January 6th of this year by Lynn J. Frazier of North Dakota in the Senate and by Ernest Lundeen in the House. This bill provides genuine, adequate Social Security along the same lines provided in the Lundeen Bill of last session. This bill was favorably reported by the House Committee on Labor. The new Frazier-Lundeen Bill is worked out in greater detail and with many points clarified. But the fundamental principles are the same. We insist on the basic principles of genuine Social Security. We would set up a nationwide federal system. Unemployment is a national problem. The Frazier-Lundeen Bill goes into effect immediately and provides for all workers, including wage earners, all salaried workers, farmers, professionals, and the self-employed. It guarantees an income equal to average earnings, but in no case less than $10 a week plus $3 for each dependent. It maintains the American standard of living. It provides a democratic system of administration by representatives of workers' organizations under a system of civil service free from political control. Finally, the Frazier-Lundeen Bill lays down the policy that additional funds needed for Social Security shall be raised by taxation on high incomes and corporate surpluses. No tribute is levied on the worker or upon the employer whose income is not in the upper brackets. I wish to give full credit to the Interprofessional Association, Mary Van Cleek Chairman, an organization with 21 chapters throughout the United States, in the matter of drafting the bill and submitting the same to Congress. Professional people are awakening to the necessity of their joint action with other workers and farmers. Now you may say, where will you get the money? How much will it cost? The Frazier-Lundeen Bill authorizes an appropriation of $5 billion for Social Security. A United Press dispatch of January 6th says that so far, the Depression has cost us $17.3 billion. That is the figure in the president's budget presented to the Congress 2 weeks ago. $17.3 billion for agricultural aid, relief, public works, home loans, and miscellaneous aid. Where do we get the money for that? We canceled $12,087,667,000 of war debts back in 1926. Where did we get the money for that? We appropriated more than $1 billion last year for war and war preparations. Where did we get the money for that? Many of our people have been under the impression that we must have more gold to give Social Security to our people. We have about 40% of the world's gold now, and yet, according to Lloyd George, there is more poverty and misery in one great American city than in all the British Isles combined. If it is gold we need, we have the gold, and we have heavy reserves lying idle in the bank. We have reserves piled so high in banks that the Federal Reserve Board officials met in Washington a few days ago to decide what to do about it, and apparently decided to do nothing. We have gold, we have bank reserves, and we have more of greater value than all of these. The labor power of 50 million working people, the wealth of America, is not in dollars alone. We have tremendous developed and potential resources beyond the comprehension of the mind of man. Even if the profits from some of these great resources are being squeezed out by financial dictators at the expense of the people, we have these resources and sources of wealth, and they belong to the people. They can be taxed. The people can take them over, if necessary, in a peaceful and lawful manner under the Constitution of the United States. Oh, yes, we have the sources of wealth. But today, the control of these great natural resources is not in the hands of the people. That is why the people do not receive full benefit from them. 200 giant corporations control half the corporate wealth of the country. And at the present rate of concentration, by 1950, 80% of the corporate wealth of the country will be controlled by 200 giant corporations. Each year, we read of the huge salaries and dividends drawn by bankers and captains of industry. Recently, the top salaries for 1935 have been published. In 1929, Eugene Grace of Bethlehem Steel Corporation received $1,635,000 in salary and bonus. In 1935, the chairman of Bethlehem Steel Board received $250,000 in salary alone. Coca-Cola's president received $100,350. Woolworth's company's president drew $337,500. The country's largest publisher, William Randolph Hearst, drew $500,000. And so on down a long list of executive salaries. And that is not mentioning the House of Morgan and other money lords of the American financial aristocracy. In addition to salaries, there are dividends received by the same people. Dividends alone gave $1,700,000 to Samuel H. Kress of the Kress Chain Store in 1934, and $5.5 million to John D. Rockefeller, Jr. from oil interests. These statistics are compiled by Labor Research Association of New York City. We can tax these salaries and these dividends. We can apply the British rates above $5,000. As long as these great American natural resources continue to fill the greedy coffers of the super-rich, the corporations continue to function. Corporate surpluses are piled high for the rainy day. But let business become slack and profits be reduced, a great cry goes up from the corporations that they cannot afford to do business and employ labor. And that is why the American people do not derive full benefit from our enormous natural resources, because they have no control over their operation and the distribution of the wealth they produce. We, the people, have lost the ownership of the country in which we live. Farmers and workers together will find a way to regain the ownership they have lost. Labor cannot depend upon state governments and private industry to provide Social Security when depression and panic strikes. Labor pays. From 1929 to 1932, labor lost over $60 billion in wages. No one thought of asking if labor could afford it. What of the corporate surplus that captains of industry have set aside for a rainy day? Labor was not allowed to use that surplus. In 1928, the corporate surplus amounted to $47 billion. And in 1932, even in that year, it was over $36 billion. This was the amount accumulated by corporations from funds which had not been distributed. Certainly, this surplus was not produced by capital alone. It was produced by labor. It was made possible by the cooperation of capital and labor, and it should be available for labor's insurance against unemployment. Abraham Lincoln said that labor has a prior right to the fruits of toil, that capital could not exist if labor had not first existed, that labor deserves much the higher consideration. So labor has a prior claim to corporate surplus. But this fact is not recognized by industrial leaders. Capital has been permitted to draw on the surplus, while labor becomes the army of the unemployed. In contrast with labor's loss, interest payments have decreased very little during the Depression. There is no comparison with wages. Wages dropped 60% from 1929 to 1932. Interest payments dropped less than 4%. In many industries, more interest than ever was paid during the Depression. In the electric light, power, and gas industries, interest payments in 1932 were 24% higher than they were in 1929. Now wages are supposed to be rising, but higher prices offset the increase in wages. Last year, the American Federation of Labor reported that food prices rose 25% in the last 2 years, while wages rose only 8%. Purchasing power of the working people cannot be increased that way. Standards of living cannot be maintained. Workers still cannot buy back the product they produce, and unemployment still hangs over us like a great cloud of the oncoming storm. The latest reports of the American Federation of Labor shows that there are 11,650,000 American workers without jobs. The dangers to American society lie not so much in armies across the sea, nor in the agitation of radicals at home. The dangers to American democracy come from our lack of social security. A financial oligarchy has entrenched itself in America. Chain stores and chain banks are destroying the independent merchant. Industry and finance have passed far beyond the control of any state. They adopt anti-social attitudes toward the common people. They form economy leagues and liberty leagues to fight against the common people's rights. They carry on a loud-mouthed, swaggering campaign. They send the American people off on a wild goose chase against a few thousand hungry Reds while they continue their plunder. The American people must have security. They demand security in return for their patriotism, their loyalty. The strength of democratic government is no greater than the love of its people. A day may come in the not distant future when the patience of our long-suffering people is exhausted. The storm may yet break upon our heads. We stand now upon the brink of an abyss. If you ask me how much will it cost to give the security to our people, I say to you, how much will it cost not to give them security? We must calm this wail of anguish that cries out from the soul of America. We must dry this ocean of tears. I say to the Money Trust of America, you must pay and save yourselves, by the way, lest you be overwhelmed by the wrath and fury of the coming storm. Someday the money powers of this country will pay, and pay double, and then we will all know that they can pay. It can be done in a peaceful and lawful manner. It must be done, regardless of cost, to save the life of America. Thank you.
You have just heard Congressman Ernest Lundeen, former labor representative from Minnesota and introducer with Senator Frazier of a Social Security bill, discuss the need for this Social Security bill. If any of you would like a summary of the three talks made at this luncheon of the People's Lobby in Washington, just address a postcard, if you're unemployed, to People's Lobby, Washington, D.C., asking for them. Or if you're employed, please send 10 cents, as we have to meet the cost of preparing them. I'm now going to introduce Mr. Gardner Jackson, former Assistant Consumers Counsel, who, with Mr. Fred Howe, counsel, was forced out of the Consumers Counsel's office of the 3A, or the late 3A, because they tried to protect the consumer. He will tell you who gypped producer and consumer. Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Howe. To carry on the general line that Congressman Lundeen has talked about, it may surprise and shock you to learn that on the average during 1935, out of every dollar you and other consumers spent for bread, 83 3/10 cents went for transportation, processing, marketing, and distribution costs, and that only 16 7/10 cents went to the farmer who produced the wheat used in that bread. It may be news to you that for 1935, on 10 basic foods used each month by typical American families, an average of 55 6/10 cents out of each dollar paid by consumers went to processors, distributors, marketers, and transporters, and only 44 4/10 cents to the farmers raising these foods. But these figures on margins, supplied by the United States Bureau of Agricultural Economics, give only a hint of the complex of factors, the men, money, and methods making up the system, which can fairly be said to fit into the picture of those who gyp the farmer and the consumer. And from my experience in the Consumers Council office and the AAA, I can truthfully report little which fundamentally attacks this gypping process. It is true that for a period when the New Deal was young and crusading fervor was up, there was a conscientious drive to get at the facts on processing and distributing costs in the great food industries in the hope that they might get publicity which would help build a public opinion to support stern and effective regulation. One smiles in retrospect. Mr. Wallace and some of his associates looked with sympathy on this drive. In his 1934 annual report, Mr. Wallace even spoke of the possible need of having to regulate the profits of some of the giant food corporations, which, incidentally, have fared much better than any other group of industries during the Depression, a fact which is in itself a commentary on the power which they possess. But inevitably, the crusading fervor was squelched many months ago. Most of the facts on processing and distributing costs have never seen the light, and we are now facing the shaping of an agricultural program under a different name, which it is hoped the Supreme Court will tolerate. What are the prospects of the consumer and the farmer under it? Will they be gypped more or less? My guess is that they'll fare just about as they always have, unless they insist upon other treatment. But before citing an episode or two to show how the things happened under AAA and how they're almost sure to happen under any program to the detriment of consumers and some producers, it is important to point out that there are farmers and farmers. The 3 million farmers who produce 86% of this country's agricultural products are in quite a different category from that other 3 million who produce only 14% of the country's foodstuffs. The latter 3 million are the ones who really get gypped. Relatively few of them were helped much by the AAA. A great many of them, the hundreds of thousands of sharecroppers and small tenants, were definitely harmed by the scarcity program. Nor did the Army of Agricultural Labor, variously estimated at between 2 4 million, improve its lot under the AAA. I just received word this morning by wire of the eviction by plantation owners in Arkansas during the past few days of 105 families, including 28 children under 6, who are sitting on the roadside without food or shelter because they are members of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. 2 men have been shot within the past few days, and Howard Kester, one of the organizers of the union, was dragged from a church at Earl, Arkansas yesterday and barely saved from lynching. The mass of small farmers in agriculture and the consumers have thus a common bond, whether they know it or not. They are all at the mercy, unless they organize themselves in strength enough to resist, of vast mechanisms of buying and selling, which, among other anti-public interest habits, as yet abide by few strict rules as to grading for quality, either on the buying or the selling end, so that farmers are apt to be gypped going in with their products and consumers coming out. These mechanisms, owned by or in fact being great financial holding companies, which though vastly overcapitalized, have met or increased dividend payments on this overcapitalization all through the Depression. It is well to remember Secretary Wallace's statement in 1934 of milk distributors' net profits running more than 25% in the depths of the Depression in certain cities. Well, these mechanisms, with their fabulous salaries for officials and their powerful financial backing, actually dominate the market and have much effect on prices. The only move by the government which is likely to have much influence upon them towards reducing spreads and treating both farmer and consumer with more consideration is the setting up by the government of a marketing corporation, such a one as is provided in the bill introduced 2 years ago by Senator Frazier and Congressman Lemke of North Dakota. Consumers and farmers ought to urge passage of this bill. It can well be justified on the yardstick theory of President Roosevelt, if upon no other. What more fundamental an undertaking could be started than a test project by the government in the purchase and distribution of farm products? Surely that is quite as fundamental as the governmental distribution of electricity to bring down electric rates. My friends down at the Department of Agriculture tell me that the whole question of margins and spreads isn't really very important, that it might affect the farmer's income one way or another at the most by 10%, that increased efficiency, elimination of capitalization write-ups, consolidation of plants and agencies would only give the farmer and consumer an improvement of that amount to share. I somehow am not sure of their estimate, especially from what little glimpse I get into the milk distributors' affairs. But even at 10%, it seems to me well worth doing when you consider that the total commercial value of our farm production in 1935 at farm prices was $8,100,000,000. $810 million, or 10% of that, is not to be sniffed at as a saving, even in these days of governmental billions. And when you look at the consumer retail side of the picture, where the dollar value is more than doubled, you see what a colossal potential saving is involved. My Department of Agriculture friends further insist that their main job was to shift a large slice of the national income from industry to agriculture, that they had to teach the farmers what they call, off the record, mass sabotage, the same kind of sabotage industry has always practiced when depressions hit and prices don't suit them. The AAA was successful in this course of sabotage instruction. It boosted the farmers' income by billions through scarcity prices and benefit payments. But the toll was taken from Mr. and Mrs. Average Consumer, not from the industrial and finance capital groups. And as I said before, the army of dispossessed in agriculture shared little or none in the dispensation. We can all agree with the recent speech of Mr. Montgomery, Consumers' Counsel at the AAA, that consumers should concentrate on increased production as a major goal. I, for one, cannot agree with him, however, in relegating to insignificance a constant and thorough examination of the marketing and processing system in this country and publication of the facts ascertained. I would like to recall to his mind a memorandum sent from a former chief of the dairy section in AAA to a former consumer's counsel, telling the latter that publication of facts gathered on milk distribution costs must not be undertaken because such publication would be irritating and disturbing to the milk distributors, those great holding companies. concerning which the Federal Trade Commission reported in strong language last year after a limited investigation. The AA administrator supported the dairy section chief in this position. If such facts are insignificant, why should the distributors find them irritating and disturbing? And why, relating to another field, should Administrator Davis's assistant, Al Steadman, decline to permit the publication in the Consumer's Guide of Mrs. Roosevelt's outspoken statement in favor of grade labeling of canned goods and other consumer goods? Can it be that the canning industry brings pressure? Of course, it and the other food processing and distributing industries do bring pressure. To say they are influential in shaping governmental policy is putting it mildly. Their influence, it must be said regretfully, extends over to some of the leaders of agricultural organizations. It is well to recall that Secretary Wallace, in the heyday of his concern for the public interest, just about 2 short years ago, termed some of the dairy farmer leaders distributors, masquerading in overalls. And those of us who sat at hearings on marketing agreements as presumed protectors of the consumer's interest can testify to the many farmers who approached us behind the scenes to tell us stories of gypping which they said they didn't dare tell in public for fear they'd lose favor in their farmers' organization and be threatened with the loss of their market. In this connection, it is significant to note that one of the old line farm organizations has caused a break in its ranks by throwing cold water on the truly cooperative marketing efforts of large numbers of its members, efforts aimed to escape the gypping process. But valuable as these inquiries into marketing practices are, and one hopes the present Federal Trade Commission will get some more money to push its projected investigation deeply. Of course, one of the ways to kill an investigation, and it's followed often, is to give them very little money. The basic problem remains unanswered. Nor do parity prices and balanced income between industry and agriculture give the answer, as long as there are 10 to 12 million unemployed and an army of underprivileged and dispossessed in agriculture, and as long as the average American citizen, as the president says, lives on a third-class diet because of lack of purchasing power. A distribution of income between the privileged groups of agriculture and industry gets nowhere. The vast speculative debt on land and on industry may be serviced for a while through such government spending operations as the New Deal has undertaken. But unless we are to go into a fascist setup based on a depressed peasantry and a depressed industrial population, as in Germany and Italy, income must be distributed among the whole population. And that can, in my opinion, only be accomplished through increased taxation on ability to pay and through rapid socialization of our industry.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are hearing a broadcast of the luncheon session of the People's Lobby. The guest speakers on today's program, in the order of appearance, Representative Ernest Lundeen of Minnesota, author of the Social Insurance Bill, who spoke on Social Security. The second speaker, Gardner Jackson, formerly assistant to the Consumers Council of the AAA, who spoke on Who Gyps the Farmers and Consumers. Mr. Marsh, secretary of the People's Lobby, is addressing a luncheon session of this organization.
The Bankhead Farm Tenant Corporation is of particular interest because corporations, private corporations, now own close to $900 million worth of farms, most of them surplus farms. These corporations and big plantation owners want to unload on Uncle Sam, as there are about 2 million too many farmers producing commercially for our present economic setup. Not, of course, if we had a civilized society. Senator Bankhead's bill is the individual and corporation landlord way to unload. It is the basis of the president's plan for agriculture to save farm landlordism. The president, like the Secretary of Agriculture, is a land speculator, and the president has a baronial estate on the Hudson River. The American people will pay the bill, and taxpayers can't throw any Jackson Day dinners to pay off the $31 billion national debt, soon to be $34 billion. The McGrory Bill is the legislative form of the Townsend Old Age Rainbow's End pot of gold. It merely permits payment of up to $200 a month raised by a sales tax, which the consumers will pay, but won't get through with this session of Congress. The Lundeen Frazier Social Security Bill is the most intelligent, and I must say the only frankly honest, old age pension and security bill before Congress, and should be substituted for the administration social insecurity bill and the Townsend Old Age Pension Racket Bill. The Soldier's Bonus Bill will cost about $2 billion and will probably pass the Senate, not because ex-soldiers are poorer or vote more often than the unemployed. Is it because so many former soldiers have guns and all of them know how to use them? The Frazier-Lemke Bill, to which reference has been made, creates a government marketing corporation empowered to buy farm products here, process them, and sell them here and abroad. It is being kept in the Senate and House Committee on Agriculture by selfish commercial interests. The big meat packers have just asked to have the packer consent decree, which was entered in 1920, set aside so that they can start a food monopoly again. The Wagner and Ellen Bogan Government Housing Corporation bills are clever devices to subsidize land speculators under the specious pretext of subsidizing housing for low-paid workers. They will be a godsend to life insurance companies and other institutions which have overloaned on slum properties and speculative suburban land values. We need a government housing corporation, but like any effort to help farmers, it will mean merely, or chiefly at least, subsidizing speculators in land and their creditors, rather than helping either directly either poor people in the cities who need cheap housing or tenant farmers and small producing farmers. The Cramer Sedition and Tidings-McCormick Disaffection Bills are designed to prevent justified criticism of government, which is the essence of democracy. They should be defeated and their introducers rebuked. Present laws are adequate to punish any advocates of overthrowing the government by violence. Special privileges, however, are now overthrowing the government by stupidity, which is not a criminal offense, but is just as fatal as any crime. Until we write off at least $100 billion of debt, $100 billion of water in our corporations, and $50 to $60 billion of land values, we won't get out of the national mess that we're in. We are just marking time now and running in debt instead of facing the issues. There is much neutrality legislation now pending in Congress, but fortunately, there is a growing appreciation that planning for peace through international cooperation on raw materials and markets is essential to keep war out of the world picture. We cannot be satisfied merely with denouncing war. We shall have war unless we plan for peace. Up in Congress, they're fighting over again the world war, A lot of the members of the Senate who were in the Senate when the World War started have forgotten, let us hope, for the sake of trusting their truthfulness, just what did happen. Let me remind you that we had a depression and we went into the World War. We have a depression now. The present administration came into power, however, pledged not to any European war, but to a war against poverty, right here in America. If they are sincere, they will devote their efforts, the entire Congress and administration, to winning the war against poverty. And whenever they ask you for larger appropriations for the Army or Navy or the Air Forces or urge any of these sedition and disaffection bills, you can know it because they're running away from the war against poverty here in the United States. We've heard a good deal recently about the Constitution. Outstanding among the measures before Congress are resolutions to amend the Constitution so that Congress may unquestionably legislate on labor relations, general welfare, and industry. The immediate occasion for most of these resolutions are the binding decisions of the Supreme Court by unanimous vote at the NRA and by a 2-to-1 vote that the 3As are unconstitutional. Radicals and liberals, as well as many conservatives, agree that both measures restricted production, curtailed consumption, fostered monopoly and concentration of wealth and income, validated scores of billions of dollars of watered property values, and were socially undesirable. Yet radicals and shyster politicians are cussing out the Supreme Court for ending these twin menaces to national welfare. The president who sponsored these measures and the Congress which enacted them were well aware of the fact, but were playing politics with human misery. The Supreme Court's power, whether usurped or justified, to set aside legislation because of the court's whims can and should be remedied by a simple constitutional amendment permitting Congress to enact any wise or fool legislation it wants to. Congress will have to delegate power to some executive to carry out its program because a mass meeting cannot execute policies, but policies must be wise to be successful. The following of the late Huey Long and the later Father Coughlin and Dr. Townsend raises the question as to what legislation people really want. The present administration gets its powers, I regret to say, not from the consent of the governed, but from the connivance of the bribed or the subsidized. There is no Supreme Court to upset legislation in Germany, Italy, France, Poland, Austria, England, or Japan. But conditions in those countries are about as bad as is ours. I've been in all of them, except Japan, in the last 2 or 3 years. The right of Congress to legislate on all matters of general welfare should be established. But establishing such a right might, and it might very probably, lead us into suicidal inflation, further depression, and a not too remote collapse. Legality and justice are not necessarily the same. But let me tell you what can happen under the present Supreme Court's powers, the powers which they now can exercise. Congress can raise at least $5 billion a year more than it does by taxing incomes, personal and corporate. Corporate liquid surpluses amounting to about $28 billion. Estates and indirectly speculative land values. Congress can repeal over $1 billion of federal taxes on poverty and can compel states to repeal $2 billion of consumption taxes on poverty. This is the most important immediate step. And nations which are afraid to take the next step seldom take the last step peacefully. The president and both major political parties are afraid to tax the wealthy and to repeal consumption taxes, though it is necessary and perfectly constitutional. An election is coming, And it is safer to cuss out the Supreme Court and the Constitution than to do what can and should be done now. The administration is now considering how to raise $500 or $600 million by a sales tax on poverty in order to keep farmers, deserving Democrats, by making consumers pay farmers fixed charges on billions of debt they should never have incurred, rent on billions of speculative land values, and consumption taxes to which they should not be subject. No proposed substitute for the old three A's protects consumers or small producing farmers. These proposed substitutes are now going to pay farmers who've looted their soil of the fertility which nature and God gave, and reward them for this looting, and bribe them not to mine their soil anymore, and propose to make the consumers and the producers, in the little way, that is the tenant farmers and the sharecroppers, pay this bill. We might remember and should remember that there is as large a proportion of watered stock in farm valuation as in the wickedest public utility. Congress can tax honestly, but, and let me try to impress this upon every one of you, Congress in this election year will not tax honestly. It will continue to tax the producer, the consumer, by taxes on consumption of all sorts. I talked recently with an outstanding leader of the House of Representatives, of course, in the majority party, and he told me he doubted whether they would have any revenue revision at this session of Congress. Although, let me recall to you, the Democratic platform in 1932 pledged a budget balanced by a system of taxation based upon the principle of ability to pay. But this leader said he doubted whether there will be any general revenue revision, which is the immediate step, which is absolutely essential if the Lundeen-Frazier Security Bill is really going to help the unemployed now, and they've got to live now and not wait for 10 years for a reserve to be accumulated. There can be no efficient, honest, fair Social Security legislation. There can be no honest relief for farmers. There can be no honest unemployment relief unless Congress will tax those who have it. This is the acid test of this administration.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard Mr. Benjamin C. Marsh, Executive Secretary of the People's Lobby, addressing a luncheon session of this organization. Mr. Marsh also introduced to you the guest speakers on today's program. In the order of their appearance to you, Representative Ernest Lundeen of Minnesota, author of the Social Insurance Bill, who spoke on Social Security, and the second speaker, Mr. Gardner Jackson, formerly Assistant Consumers Counsel of the AAA, who addressed us on Who Gyps the Farmer and Consumer. This program has come to you from Washington, D.C., through the National Broadcasting Company.